Return to Northmoor, episode 18, running time 30 minutes.
Hi, this is Kim.
And this is Tim.
Welcome to the Return to Northmoor podcast. Today we're going to have a bit of a discussion about alignment and give you the last details on the end of our story arc.
So this is going to conclude the story arc for Return to Northmoor. The characters have gone into the Temple of Art and come back out, and we're going to meet their tormentor, the Wizardess Amara, who is the fifth member of the original adventuring party that includes the Mentor and the Ranger and the Bogman. She's the one that sent the Homunculus after them. She's the one that ordered the Raftman murdered. She's the one that's been following them around and is seeking the coins and the rods and all that.
So first of all, Tim has a shout out to one of our great forum listeners.
Yeah, so Rob Winder from the northeast of the U.S. has been sending us lots of great contributions to both enhance his Return to Northmoor experience. He's running it for his family and friends. And we've also been able to post those out in our forums for other folks to use, some enhanced maps and some ideas and some Q&A to help clarify things for those who are running this at home.
So as I understand it, Rob has a party member that is of evil alignment. And that has prompted us to have some discussions regarding alignment.
I believe it's Rob's nephew that is playing an evil character in the group. And Rob's question was, well, is it possible that his background is tied in with the evil cult that overthrew Belalacqua? And of course the answer is yes. That's exactly the kind of thing you should be doing, is taking a look at the background of your characters and weaving them into a story, even if that story is hundreds and thousands of years old. The fact that he has an evil PC is an interesting concept, though, and it's one of the reasons that I set up the Northmoor background the way I did. Since all of them are descendants of people from Belalacqua, that doesn't mean they all have to be good. They could be elves, they could be dwarves, they could be of any race and any alignment. That said, I think that that brings up some interesting opportunities for role-playing and future possible fractures within the party.
I've been in a number of role-playing groups, and we've tried a number of different tactics on how to keep things fresh and new. And in the way back machine of my memory of gaming, we had one group that decided we were all going to play evil characters. Now, this is in the days of 3.5, so there was lawful evil, chaotic neutral, etc., etc. And that gaming session, I think, lasted perhaps 4 entire episodes. That was it. In the end, many of us killed our party members, and then the two of us who were left surviving walked in opposite directions, never to see one another again.
And that's typically what happens when you have evil party members, is it's very difficult for folks of evil alignment to stick around with other people. Even if they themselves would be happy to continue to hang around with those people, unfortunately, the goodly types don't necessarily want them hanging around.
Exactly. You know, you're willing as a good character to deal with some of the crap that an evil character brings with them, but only until the job is done. And then they're either put into jail, ostracized from the group, whatever you can do to get rid of that evil character.
And oftentimes they end up, through actions of their own, getting themselves killed, either accidentally or through machinations of the rest of the party.
We are not talking about the times where I played the evil character in a good group. Didn't start out that way, but ended up that way, and it usually ended poorly. There were at least two times that I can remember where my character was slowly brought over to the dark side, and that didn't end well.
In fact, I seem to remember one of those times you ended up not talking to the other players in your group for a couple years after the campaign ended.
Just one of them took it a little seriously, a little personally, and we did not speak for 2 years after that last episode.
Just a warning to all of you out there. Playing evil may seem expedient at the time, but there's reasons that we don't recommend it. And in 4E, we wanted to talk about some of the changes they made to the alignment system, where now there's good, lawful good, evil, chaotic evil, and then unaligned. Unaligned is what a lot of the characters in our group are.
Absolutely. And in fact, my character is unaligned. And I have a little bit of a different take on the unaligned nomenclature than what is presented in the 4E guidebooks.
One of the ways to look at it is the way that the Rush song Free Will said of, if you choose not to decide, you've still made a choice, and that's it. It's not that you haven't decided. You've literally decided not to choose a particular path. And Kim, why was your character choosing to be unaligned?
My character became unaligned because she was in a position from her family where I think that she probably started off as good. Maybe not 100% good, but pretty good. And then because of the political structure of the Feywild and her position in that society, it warped her in such a fashion that you come to the point where if I choose poorly, I will get killed. If I make a different choice, then I will be labeled as something that I don't want to be. So I would rather not make a choice at all.
But you had to make a choice, and so you chose, I guess, to keep your options open?
Absolutely. Keep my options open. That, as the listeners will find out in the future, did not end well either, as that character was killed in her youth, and then that is why she ended up being in the Prime Material Plane. So sometimes not making a choice doesn't end well either.
So let's talk a little bit about how 4E changed the way the alignment works. First of all, they eliminated all the combinations of alignments that were there simply in order to have one of every combination. Well, we had lawful goods must mean we have to have lawful evil, and thus sort of the fill-in-the-holes mentality.
Conversely, we had chaotic evil, so therefore we have to have chaotic good.
Right. And those shades were so thin and narrow between them. I mean, some people, of course, felt very adamantly that they weren't thin shades and that they were very clear, but explaining them to a new player was always a challenge. So now you have the person who's more about order over good, good at any cost, evil at any cost, or evil when it's convenient. And then you have the unaligned, which we just talked about. So I think that that clarifies things in terms of those shades are a little clearer than they used to be because they're not adding in all the other combinations. But what my fear is that unaligned starts to smell a whole lot like what chaotic neutral used to be, which is I will do anything I want all the time and I have no code or predictability to my behavior.
And that's particularly dangerous at a role-playing table because your party members don't know what to expect from you, nor does the GM. And from week to week, they really need to kind of pace their characters according to that chaotic neutral character. For instance, 1 week, a chaotic neutral character could be working as a candy striper with the Clerics Guild, giving out lollipops to the local orphans. And then the very next week, they could be stabbing those same orphans in the eyes because it suits their fancy. And that's very difficult, especially if you have a number of lawful good characters in the party to deal with.
And I think unaligned is a lot more narrow than that. In fact, what unaligned is really saying is, I'm not passionate enough about either of those that I could swing all the way from one to another. I'm really just sort of down the even, straight and narrow, staying in the middle and trying to just get on by with my life without necessarily working toward or against anybody else's.
Now, Tempest is also unaligned. The way I look at the unaligned status is she will do whatever is expedient at the moment that it's happening for the situation for herself as well as her party. So if it's expedient to perhaps torture somebody, she's not going to like it, but maybe that's what they need to do in order to get the job done. On the other hand, she doesn't have a problem giving out donations to whichever charity happens to need it in the city as well.
So how is that different than chaotic neutral then?
I think that a lot of it is thinking about the actions that she takes and how it's going to affect those around her, rather than just taking it on as a selfish act towards what she's doing and how it's going to benefit her.
So do you think that everyone who plays unaligned has that same opinion?
Probably not.
So that's something to keep in mind. We'd love to hear your thoughts in our forums. This has always been a complex topic. And although 4E has removed some of the strangeness that was there because of all the different combinations, I think that unaligned still has that smell of I get to do whatever I want whenever I want.
Well, I don't think that Tempest does whatever she wants whenever she wants to do it. There's been a number of times that there are role-playing opportunities, and while she wants to just walk away from the entire situation, that's not what's going to happen. One way or the other, she's going to have to deal with this party and do things that she finds either unpalatable or unacceptable for the situation, because that's what the team needs to do.
Things to consider. Again, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And of course, all of this plays well into the broader story of what's going on in Belalacqua and all of that. So specifically, let's talk a little bit about Amara. So Amara is a wizardess. She was the fifth member of the original party that explored the Star Temple, along with the ranger and the bogman and the mentor.
There was another person who was the thief of the party.
So Amara was the wizardess, and she was very good friends with the thief. When they came back from their misadventure in the Star Temple, she tried to remove the rod from the thief, and unfortunately his soul was lost during the process. She was not able to get him raised, and of course he didn't come back. which sort of scattered the whole group and made them realize that they were in big trouble and that this wasn't just a momentary setback. It also drove Amara very insane and crossed her over into the evil territory. She'd primarily been unaligned before then, but the loss of her friend and the knowledge that she had something to do with it pushed her over the edge into that evil category.
Perhaps she was naive in thinking that, well, even if he died, we can always bring him back.
Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. So do you think this is a lesson for Tempest, what happened to Amara?
Well, it's a possible lesson, but I think that perhaps Tempest is a little bit stronger than that.
Amara is a character who's a very tragic figure. She was a wizardess on the Prime, she was a rising star, and unfortunately this misadventure really not only ended her career, but ended up losing the soul of her friend and breaking up the adventuring team and really completely destroying everything she'd worked toward. And unlike the bog man who could just go hang out in the bog and still be close to nature, or the ranger who could at least run an inn, or the mentor who ran up to military and was able to kind of bluff his way on his previous reputation and continue to do that, Amara really had nothing left.
Except for the king, clearly.
So she was the one that had originally brokered the deal with the king, and she was very close to him. The king, of course, is dying and is desperately trying to find various magic items and aids to continue to keep him alive. For some reason, he's extremely afraid of dying, and we really haven't come across why that is yet. He has continued to try to prolong his life through magic items, so he has a tremendous store of them. So even though Amara doesn't have the powers that she did as a wizard, she definitely has the powers of the magic items that he's given her. And when they confront her here in this encounter that's coming up, she will be blasting at them with the magic items she got from the king.
You will find when you listen to the actual play that Tim's allusion of will this be a good lesson for Tempest is rather interesting, because after this encounter, Tempest pretty much decides that Amara is her mortal enemy. And considering that they're very much alike at the base, you can see where it might be a life lesson to learn from.
Well, and that's the kind of drama that I think is very delicious, is to say, you know, we've got these two people, both of whom have paths that they made slightly different choices on and could have perhaps been great friends if things had turned out differently.
Instead, things end poorly.
Amara is going to confront the PCs. They're going to be coming out of the Temple of Art, and as you heard last time in our actual play, there is a group of folks who have tied up the bog man in a boat, and they are waiting there for the PCs to come out. Amara is invisible, hidden nearby, and there's a lot of different ways you can play this depending on the character of your group. One way is just to have them demand that they give up the orb. This orb is what Amara has been looking for this whole time. It's what she believes that the rods and the coins will help her get. This orb is what the king has charged her to go and find. She knows that the orb was hidden inside a temple somewhere inside the bog. She knows the PCs have gone inside the temple, so she believes that they grabbed it and have come out, because it would have been the biggest prize within. Of course, the PCs have no such thing.
And they're incredibly confused about this demand. Give us the orb or we'll kill the bog man. And it's like, do we run across anything that looked like an orb?
So their first thought is going to be that they've forgotten something, or they missed a room, or maybe, you know, something they have is the orb and it's disguised or something like that.
I think that maybe a thought was, just a minute, let us go back and find out if we can find that thing. Or worse yet, was the orb that flame skull that we blew up in the end?
There's some fun role-playing and discussion that can happen as a result of this demand for something that they do not have. So you can play it a couple different ways. The group demands the orb, and then when they don't have it, then Amara appears to save the PCs from these mercenaries who work for a guild called the Merchant's Guild. I'll save you. If you just give me the orb, I'll protect it from these people. Or some other negotiation that you think might work on your party. Again, if you've got someone who's very soft-hearted, perhaps she's been captured by them and, you know, there's another hostage, or lots of other possibilities to good cop, bad cop them.
Conversely, you can have the mercenary leader say, well, if you don't give us the orb, she is going to be really upset and you don't want to face her at all. And have that kind of as a background threat.
Build her up before she even sort of appears on the scene.
And then as the battle starts in, and she kind of can come in blazing and really frighten your PC.
She has got a few of her wizard skills still. Pretty much the first level spells and the cantrips and all that she can still fire off. So when she does appear, it'll be a big prestidigitation flame spurt. She'll appear, she's got two wands, a wand of Scorching Burst and a wand of Magic Missile, and she'll start firing those off, alternating back and forth. forth between the PCs.
Amara primarily wants to take out the spellcasters of the party. She will have the mercenary leader be the one to take out the strongest, toughest fighter of the group.
And then the rest of the attack group is comprised of minions, and the minions will flood everyone else and try to keep them from being effective. And the terrain here, it's the same map that we had during the Kumat battle, that big hole in the ground that leads down into the temple, then there's a little bit of land and then a whole lot of bog around it. So make sure you use that terrain to best effect. You know, they can end up getting knocked in the hole, and I've provided some stats about what it would take to fall in the hole. They can end up slogging down into the water. There was a great scene that you'll hear in the actual play where Rogan ends up throttling the mercenary leader and trying to hold his head underwater and isn't able to do it, and it's all very exciting.
Also remember that the corpse of the Kumat could still be there, and so maybe the PCs are going to try to barter their way out of this, saying, well, we killed this creature, so we can easily take you out. You know, you can see how this could go a lot of different ways.
And if you want to get really creative, perhaps Amara has a magic item that has animated the Kumat, and he's on their side. If you have six or more PCs that are really tough, they should all be third level by now. Perhaps she's made the Kumat into a zombie, and he can be fighting as well. You've got so many possible options.
That would be totally ugly.
Feel free to be as creative as you want here, but the main idea is that this is their chance to confront Amara, who's been tormenting them. So she's going to need a little time to monologue and tell people who she is, and she's the one that sent the homunculuses after them. She's the one that killed the Raftmaster. She's the one that's been seeking the rods and the coins. All of this to try to get that orb for her master, the king.
There probably will be some questions. I know at least a number of our party members had the question of, well, what do the rods really mean? What do the coins really mean? What's really going on? Why does she want them? And you have to remember, Amara is insane. So you can kind of rattle off about anything you want to, and that way they're going to be completely off kilter for a while.
And she's done a bunch of research, but she's been trying to figure this out for a really long time, and she has only very scattered information. And we'll talk in a future episode where we sort of lay out all of the background plots and everything that's going on here, which should be coming up soon, why that is, that she's only got a tiny bit of information. All she knows for sure is that if she gets the rods and she gets the coins, somewhere in a swamp, there will be a temple where she can find the orb, which her king has promised her, if he returns it to her, she will have the rod removed from her and all of her friends.
So you say that she's still trying to help her friends out.
She's insane, so removing the rod from her would be good enough. And the friends thing is something that sometimes matters to her, and sometimes she could care less.
Okay, then.
So you got to remember, she's very unstable. So what this encounter then will be is a huge battle. There will be much excitement. Amara will be flinging off, you know, spells left and right. You can feel free to include any additional spells or magic items or anything else you think would make this a more interesting battle for your group. For us, in order to keep it easy to run, I stuck with Magic Missile Scorching Burst. Then she has a bunch of defensive magic items that essentially allow it that when she gets to zero hit points, she immediately teleports away to a place of safety. And the magic items are laid out such a way that that's very clear and very predetermined that that's going to happen. She'll get away and she'll come back to torment the PCs another day. However, when we did our battle, it came down to the wire and the PCs were about to die and she was about to fry the last group of them. So I had already planned to have the hole-in-the-water inn raft arrive to pick up the PCs because the boat had been destroyed, the bogman was tied up, they needed some way to get out of here. So what I ended up having happen is they pull up and Renar, the ranger, puts a bolt through Amara, which kind of finishes her off and knocks her down just long enough for the PCs to get on the raft so they can get away.
As I recall, there was a little battle, mano-a-mano style catfight between Tempest and Amara.
Yes, well, that was the first one, of course. Far later in the future, there is another to come. This scene was supposed to be sort of like that scene at the end of the first Star Wars movie, where Han Solo swoops in and just knocks off Darth Vader long enough for Luke to finish what he was originally doing. So make sure that you don't have this be that they swoop in and finish off Amara and kill off all the rest of the mercenaries and the PCs feel like they weren't successful. This should be something where it's like, wow, we're almost there, but it's just not going to make it. This is going to be it. And then suddenly they come in and do the smallest thing and they can get away.
So, Tim, I notice on your character sheet for Amara, you have her as a medium aberrant humanoid. Can you explain that?
So the reason that it says aberrant is aberrations are things that are their sources from the far realm, and Amara has been heavily corrupted by influences from the far realm.
So that automatically puts that kind of nomenclature on.
Well, she has been so far corrupted that her origin has actually changed to aberrant.
Great.
Tasty, huh?
Tasty.
Battle Royale, the raft, the hole in the water inn, comes in to either save them at the last minute or to help them finish her off, or if your group isn't going to take well to that, and you know, you'll have to gauge them, then essentially they finish off Amara, they finish off the rest of them, and they're stranded in the swamp with a boat that's completely broken and a tied up unconscious Bogman, at which point the raft appears from the mists and is just there as transport to get them back to the Lost Village.
So after they start getting back into town, they're probably licking their wounds from at least two battles. And more than likely, if their group is anything like ours was, taking inventory of the things that they've seen and the things that they've taken out.
So at this point, you can have the ranger and the mentor and such give them as much information as possible. The mentor, of course, is going to wake up at this point, and he'll be there to discuss things with them. He had been unconscious up until pretty much he's back on the Hole in the Water Inn. But he'll have healed up at that point, and he can talk to them. And he may be able to provide them some answers, such as that he believes the coins are a means to disable the effect of the temples. The effect being that no one seems to remember where they are and has a hard time finding them and sticking around in them. And that may be why the PCs were able to actually get in and find it, is because they had the coin.
At this point, it will be a reunion of sorts as well, because they haven't seen their mentor for quite some time.
And so that's a great opportunity for a lot of really great role-playing as the raft continues to make its way back toward the Lost Village. Take your time, role-play up the reunions with the mentor, the reactions of Amara. They're going to, you know, be clear that she's gone off the deep end, and they're going to understand that she's against them now, and that there's all kinds of things that may reveal from a role-playing perspective.
And they may want more information about this former adventuring group. They've met pretty much all the people that they can at this point, and with the appearance of Amara, they're going to have some questions of, was she like this before? What has happened? How could she ever be corrupted? Do you think the king has something to do with it? So you have a lot of options with that kind of role-playing.
So they're going to be able to assume quite easily that she's gone off the deep end. She's probably completely insane at this point due to the death of the rogue that was with them previously, and that she's working for the king. They had sort of suspected that before, but now they'll just essentially confirm it.
So on their way back to the Lost Village, or at least the travel time on the Hole in the Water Inn, the PCs get to make a lot of decisions. What are they going to do next? They can decide that perhaps they want to go to the city and have a showdown with Amara and the king. Perhaps they want to go back to the outpost and make sure everything is okay there. You have a lot of different options.
The way that we did it, and this is what we'll present to you here, is that when they get close to returning to the Lost Village, someone, a friend from the town, runs up out of the bog and says, "You can't go in there. The town's under martial law." Nolar.
And wasn't that Sergeant Rose in our case?
Actually, believe it or not, it wasn't Sergeant Rose in your case. It was Dan's new PC, Pyre.
Ah.
This is a great opportunity to, if you want to have someone switch PCs, or if you need to change people in and out of the group, or if someone's passed on and you need to bring out a new character, this is a great opportunity to do that. This is an old friend of theirs that was hiding in the town and escaped before martial law clamped down. Because what's happened is Nolar, who was running the other two outposts, if you recall, there's three outposts. There was the main one that the mentor and the PCs had been at, and then there was two smaller ones that were up the coastline that they hadn't necessarily gotten along well with. Well, those were being run by Nolar, the former sword teacher to the king, and he has returned, declared martial law in the Lost Village, and is actively seeking the mentor and the bog man and the ranger for treason against the king. He has quote-unquote evidence that they let the Sahuagin into the outpost and were responsible for the deaths of all those people up there and sacrificing the security of the area.
So, of course, this causes a great deal of consternation amongst the PCs, because here they are, with three of those wanted individuals, and they themselves are possibly wanted as well.
Rumor has it that they are people of interest, and that if they are found, they are to be stopped in questions as to the location of the mentor and such.
Of course, if you have PCs that have a great deal of loyalty to the outpost, they're going to want to do something about this situation. Plus, they really don't trust this king person anyway.
The more that they discuss this, the less they trust the king, and that's sort of the idea. So, at this point, they have the choice, if you play it this way, of trying to sneak into the city, which is under martial law by a bunch of very powerful characters, and it will be no problem for them to discuss that they'll be way outclassed and that it will be a big deal, but they might be able to sneak in, perhaps, but they're risking capture. Or they can try to return to the outpost, which is now pretty much abandoned, as Nolar and all of his troops are now here in the Lost Village, and they can try to find evidence to the contrary, something to prove that someone else was responsible for letting the Sahuagin in, so that when that does happen, they can hold that up and prove the innocence of the mentor and his friends.
Well, and the PCs already have the fact of the matter that the Sahuagin weren't necessarily just after the outpost, but they were also trying to infiltrate the Temple of Art. And they have a lot of evidence to say that they were there, as well as probably that big crown or a very large trident that the Baron Sahuagin was carrying around.
But them showing up in the Lost Village with that crown and trident is going to make them look awfully suspiciously as if they were associating with the Sahuagin, and perhaps those were bribery gifts.
Perhaps, unless, of course, somebody had the foresight to bring home a head or two.
All very interesting, and things that will hopefully spark a lot of different role-playing. The idea being the town is under martial law, and they can't go back there without making a big scene and taking a lot of risk. Now, you don't have to play it this way. This is the end of the story that we're going to present to you here. So you can, at this point, go ahead and fork off 100 different ways. You can have them go ahead and return to the Lost Village triumphant, drink their money away, sell off all of their stuff, and buy new magic items, and have lots of adventures centered in and around the Lost Village.
They could also take off to the city, where they could be confronting the king, or at least some of his lower-level minions once they get there, and have an entire city adventure.
Or you can have someone come in and say they have found another star temple in the northeast in the mountains, and that they think that the PCs and the former adventurers should come and try to break into that one, and that perhaps that will be the cure for the rods embedded in them.
So there are a lot of different options that you can pursue.
So we'll present in a future episode sort of some background about what's going on with the rods and the coins and the star temples and all that, that you can use to sort of fuel your own storylines from here. We did continue our campaign from this point. However, we quickly realized that it became so customized and so tailored to our PCs, which is what we hope happens to your group as well, that it would be very difficult to present that in a material way that anyone could use in their group. You would pretty much have to follow the same path that our group did, that was heavily influenced by the background of the characters and so forth, that it would be almost impossible for us to present that in a way that would make sense to you. For example, what happens directly after this is the PCs do return to the outpost, and they find some evidence that tells them that they need to go to the Feywild to get a cure for Sergeant Rose, who ends up being poisoned. When they do that, they find a bunch of more information, but it ends up being mostly tied around Tempest's background and that sort of thing.
We can provide you, if interested, with some of the city locations in the Feywild, as well as some of those characters, because they are quite good. We also are thinking about releasing some of the Rod actual play that we participated in.
So the good news is our campaign really took off and achieved the goal that we had hoped it would, which is to be tightly integrated with the backgrounds of the characters and really have the story driven from those backgrounds. But unfortunately, the side effect was that it makes it almost impossible for us to present that as something that would be generically useful to all of you. We hope that you've enjoyed our presentation of Return to Northmoor. The next episode will be the actual play of this battle with Amara, after which we have some other meta stuff coming up, and then we hope that you will continue to tune in as we present either further actual play without this sort of episode describing what happens, as well as some other meta discussions that we hope to bring in the future.
All right, well, that's it for now, so thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronalyn's Tower, Legends of Cithilin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten. Used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronalyn.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.